You know, I put some water up here and people kept drinking it. See, you prefer that I hold it like this? Okay, great. Wow, spiritual speaker. That is... I would never think of myself as spiritual. I would never declare that, but it is an honor. I want to, you know, I served on 9 area conventions, and I know how much work goes into a convention. It is a year-long process, and there's just not enough accolades and not enough applause for the convention committee. So let's give the convention committee another big round. James 5, verse 19 and 20. If a person should lose their way from the truth, and the truth being God, and we certainly lose our way to God as we are when we're untreated, and another person should show them the path back to that truth, like we do in sponsorship, that person will not only have saved a soul, but cover a multitude of sin. And those of you that are sponsoring others know about that paycheck that God hands down to us for the efforts that we do. My name is Cameron. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. So one of the things I love to do when I'm in the rooms is I like to ask people about their program. And, you know, the question I say is, are you working a program? And the most common response I get is, oh, yeah, I work a program. I go to a meeting every day, sometimes 3 meetings a day. Meeting makers make it, 90 and 90. And I go, no, that's not what I'm speaking about. Are you working with someone? Oh, yeah, I got a sponsor. Call my sponsor every day. My sponsor makes all my decisions for me. He tells me who I can sleep with, how to manage my money. You know, I don't make a decision until I talk to my sponsor. I've heard some crazy-ass shit out of sponsors. I remember this one woman, she was told by her sponsor to go to the largest meeting in Toronto. This was an AA meeting, about 350 people at this meeting. And she had to show up in her pajamas. Like, who comes up with these kinds of ideas? I was working with another woman. She was pissed at her sponsor. I said, what are you so angry at your sponsor for? And she said, well, he told me in order for me to get well, I had to clean his house twice a week. And I ain't getting any better. And I thought, well, Dr. Bob did say clean house. I don't think he meant it quite so literally. I was talking to a fellow a couple months ago, and he's telling me he's building a backyard deck, and he was at the hardware store buying screws. And he says, Cameron, I got to go. I got to call my sponsor to let him know what screws I'm buying. And I think someone's got a screw loose here, right? Like, that's not what we do as sponsors. And I go, no, that's not what I'm talking about. I said, are you working with newcomers? And they look at me like I got 3 bloody heads on. They go, newcomers? I'm still a newcomer. I've only been in the program 2 years. This is a selfish program. I got to work on me first. And you know what? I never see them again. The untreated addict, you know, they're interesting people. And they have this uncanny ability. And I certainly had this uncanny ability. I like digging. I like digging holes. And I dig a very deep hole. And being the nature of an untreated addict, I fall into my hole and I get stuck and I cry out for help. And some of the first people that come along to try to help me down in the hole are my friends, my family, my employer. You know, they offer those frothy emotional appeals. They bail me out of trouble. They're forever extending that ladder down to the hole and saying, please, Cameron, please climb out and be with us. We love you so much. And what do? I trade the ladder in for a 20-piece and I dig the hole a little deeper, right? And I cry out for help. And then the religious community comes along and says, here, we have a solution for you down there in the hole. Let us read this scripture for a while. I'll kneel and pray with you. But because it's a program of faith without works, it avails the addict very little power. And I realize, you know, I'm still in the hole. Then the medical community comes along. Oh, I love the medical community. They're very motivated at helping us addicts. And they come up with all sorts of solutions for us. Antabuse, Suboxone, methadone, clorazepam, diazepam, perazepam. And my doctor goes, Cameron, you're depressed. I said, you think? I've burned my life to the ground. Nobody wants to be around me. Yeah, I'm depressed, but I'm trying to get off pills. I don't need more pills in my life. And the trouble with the pill regime is the prescriptions expire, and then the pills run out, and the awful pain of being an untreated addict comes down to bear upon me. And then lastly, along comes the multi-billion dollar treatment center with their 1% success rates and their two-year college-educated addiction counselors. And they say, here, we got a solution for you untreated addicts. It's called group. Y'all been to group? And, you know, the thing that drives me crazy is they bring group into our meetings. I don't know if you've ever been to one of these meetings. I call them open, disgusting meetings. And, you know, and Hollywood seems to portray us this way, where you see a group of very despondent-looking people sitting in a circle. There's no solution. There's no cross-sharing, no cross-talk. It's just problem, 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 like an incessant Oprah wine fest. Like group therapy without a therapist. And by the end of the meeting, I'm a psychological casualty of this group. And now I need a meeting to fix the meeting I was supposed to get the hope, faith, and courage at. They're just awful meetings. And of course, in treatment, they always ask that wonderful question, how do you feel? I go, how do I feel? As an untreated addict, I have two feelings. I feel like using, and I feel like murdering you. Those are the only two feelings I got, right? How do I feel? Oh, my God. And then after about an hour of sharing, the counselor goes, you're all beautiful people, but I practice a professional class of therapy, and I got to go pick up my paycheck, but I'll see you next week. And I realize I'm still in the hole. Now, I got good news and bad news. The good news is there is a way out of the hole. The bad news is if you be an untreated addict of the seemingly hopeless variety, chances are you're too dishonest, too selfish, too self-seeking, and too frightened to do the work, and you're going to die. That's going to be an awful death. Over the last 18 and a half years, and I keep track of everyone I ever work with, I do a workshop called 12 Steps in 4 Hours. And we have a saying, it only takes a day to learn it and the rest of your life to practice it. And since COVID started, when I did them locally, we'd average about 20 members per month. We did the last Sunday of the month. But COVID had a silver lining for us because we went on the Zoom platform and we average 200 to 300 people a month now. And we've taken over 5,000 people through the steps in just a little over 2.5 years. Amazing. Out of that mix, I personally worked with, when I take someone through the steps one-on-one, I do it in about 10 days. I've taken a little over 400 people through that process, and 42 are dead. 42 that I've worked with are dead. I've lost count over the hundreds of others I've heard die over the years, but 42 that I work with directly are dead. And I bury most people to alcohol death. Alcohol is still the most dangerous drug out there. It can kill you when you detox from it. It can kill you when you drink it. And it's a dangerous substance. Fentanyl is making a play for number two up in our local area in Toronto, Ontario. But another drug that I find really bad, and I read a statistic recently that a third of Americans are on a benzo of some sort, those clorazepams, diazepam, and they're a dangerous drug while being on them or certainly coming off of them, and it's a real problem out there. So, you know, our stories are supposed to disclose in a general way what we were like. Sometimes I hear what it was like, but our story, as our big book instruction says, what we were like, what happened, what we're like today. You know, I always know I'm in for one of those long drunkologues. You know, the member gets up and goes, I remember my first drink. I was in my mother's third trimester. And I realized I didn't drink like other fetuses. Oh, God, here we go, right? It's like, oh, my God. So what was I like as an untreated addict? I love drinking. I drink bourbon. I like smoking dope. I like smashing cocaine. And It's all of everything is an untreated act. I just absolutely love it. It's the only thing I want to do, and it's the most important thing in my life. I love it more than every job I was fired from. I got fired so many times, I thought, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. That way I'm going to be my own boss. No one can fire me then. Yeah, that was a rude awakening. I was really irresponsible as a father. I had a 4-year-old son at the time. He's 38 now, but when he was about 4 years old, I used to share needles. This was back before AIDS had been diagnosed in the mid-80s. And I would share dirty. I knew it wasn't right. I knew there was something wrong about it, but I didn't care. I was just hanging for another hit, and I only had one tool. And in those days, you couldn't buy needles like you could today. The pharmacist wouldn't sell them to you. So, you know, I'm digging through the rubbish bin trying to find a needle I used the other day. I'm sharpening it on an emery board and all that crazy-ass stuff. And I remember waking up one day, and my son, who's 4 years old, is playing squirt guns with one of my dirty fits. And I felt awful. I felt awful as a father. But that did not have the power to sober me up. I love the effect of alcohol and drugs so much in my life that I'm willing to risk everything, including my own life. I remember in 2000, my doctor diagnosed me with liver disease. He says, Cameron, your liver's descended, your enzymes are through the roof. You got liver disease, and if you don't stop, you're going to die. And the first thought that crossed my mind was, oh, I need a drink now. Like, that's awful news, right? Now, the muggles, you know, some people call them earth people. Some people call them normies. I call them muggles. That's a Harry Potter term for non-wizards. My wife's a muggle. She doesn't get me at all in that respect. She's what I call a JDD girl. Just don't drink, just don't drug. You know, and that really is the solution. But for some reason, I can't seem to implement or apply that solution in my life. You know, there's a passage out of the Book of Solomon that I use because I've done a fair amount of speaking in AA, and of course, I love CA because we can be grittier. We can be really, you know, I can have conversations in CA that I can't have in AA, and certainly not with the muggles. I mean, you know, sometimes I'm at a party and I forget I'm amongst the muggles and I'll be saying something, and all of a sudden there's just awkward silence. Was it something I said? So I pulled this passage as an analogy for the untreated addict. I'm like a dog that returns to its own vomit. You ever seen a dog that eats something that makes it foully sick and it throws it up? And then what does the dog do? It eats the vomit, only to throw it up again, only to eat the vomit. That's what I'm like as an untreated addict. I'm like a dog that continuously returns to its own vomit. And I know it's going to make me sick, but it tastes so good, right? And it's baffling to me why I keep doing this. So our big book talks about that strange mental blank spot, that phenomenon that parallels our sound reasoning that fails to hold us in check. I call it the liar. I got this liar that lives in my head, and the liar loves the effect produced by alcohol and drugs, and under no circumstance does it want to give it up. So it's built this research institute in my brain called Bullshit Inc. And it's researching new ideas, new excuses, new justifications, new reason, even though my life's in the toilet. This time when I do it, it's going to be okay. Y'all relate to that liar that lives inside her head trying to convince us to go back out? And here's the problem. The liar would always, always win the argument. I have no defense against that liar. Now, in the beginning, now, I'm generally, my default position, my emotional default position is restless, irritable, discontented, bored, depressed, anxious. And I don't like feeling that way. So my solution is to drink and use. See, drinking and using is not my problem. That's my solution. Running out is a problem. But drinking and drugging was my solution. Because as soon as I started drinking or using again, I always remember when I would relapse, it was like, wow, why did I ever quit? This is exactly the way I want to feel, right? And then I'm off with it. Now, in the beginning, it seemed like the answer. Remember when we first started drugging or drinking? Remember that amazing effect? And we went, yeah, this is the way I want to be. This is the way I want to exist 24/7. And it started off as that luxury, but our illness is progressive and it gets more and more insidious and darker. And it gets to the point where I'd like to tell you, I'm just going to go to the pub, have a pint, a couple shots of bourbon and go home. And I really believe that's what I'm going to do. But once I start, that weird phenomenon of the spree starts to take place. And all addicts, regardless of their addiction pattern, whether it be drugs, alcohol, or even the acting out addictions like sex, food, gambling, hoarding, whatever, they all go through these three stages. So the first stage is the spree. Once I start, it comes out. I got no control. I can't predict how long I'm going to be doing it. Could last a night, could last a day, could go on for a week, a month, a year. I have no idea. And then at some point, I emerge from the spree. I have a moment of clarity, and I'm full of remorse and horror and hopelessness. And I make a firm resolution not to do it again. We've all done that, right? Make that firm resolution. And I'm convinced that they hooked up any one of us to lie detector tests, it would register as truthful. But what happens? Now, I know I can't live with the booze and drugs anymore, but I have no idea how to live without it. So I'm told to go to meetings. And I go to a meeting, especially one of those open, disgusting meetings. And I sit there and there's no solution and I enter into what I call sobriety. And as I sit there with no solution, I can't live with it, but they're not showing me any way how to live without it. And I dry out and I start getting restless and irritable and discontented and bored and depressed. And the liar comes out of remission and says, hey, we need our solution. And the liar would always win the argument, and I would succumb to the desire, and out I would go, pursuing my love of drinking and drugging through that spree, remorse, resolution. Spree, remorse, resolution. Pursuing my love to the gates of insanity or death. Raise your hand if you know someone who's died from addiction. I look around the room, folks. Everyone knows somebody, right? The other problem I see in the rooms, now out of the 42 people that I've buried, 9 hung themselves in sobriety. Now, why would someone hang themselves sober? And what happens is they sit there in the meetings. Now, they don't relapse. They go insane. And you might have met some of these folks in the rooms. 5, 10 years sobriety, but whatever they got, I don't want it. Oh, my God. And they end up taking their own lives. In the Oxford Handbook to Psychiatry, there's a passage where it talks about suicide and alcoholism. It says it's 80 times higher than normal society. 80 times. I had to read the stat twice. You are 80 times more likely to take your own life in the first 5 years of untreated addiction. And it's a real problem. I've lost 9 that way. And some of you may have known people that have committed suicide in our rooms who just could not, would not live our way of life. And this is the horror. This is the sucker punch of step one. Step one is not a fun step. Step one is the death step. I'm going to die on step one. Everything in my experience tells me I will drink. I will use again. Nothing secular, nothing human can stop this train wreck from happening. And that's an awful conclusion to come to in step one. Yet I come into the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous, and I meet people who are just like me, who've gone down the rabbit hole as far as I've gone or even further, and they don't do it anymore. How is that possible? I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. Now, that's an odd thing for any one of us to admit, right? That's a paradox, right? Because everything in our experience tells us we're going to drink and use again. Yet there's so many of us in this room. We in our countdown last night, we had Jennifer here with 41 years and down through the multiple digits of self-admitted alcoholic addicts who don't drink or use. That's a very compelling picture to someone who wants to stop, can't stop, and meet some of us who have stopped. And I was fortunate enough when I came into the rooms, I met someone who was armed with the facts about themselves. They knew what it was like to live in that hole. They knew what it meant to be an addict. More importantly, they had a solution, our common solution, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a generosity of spirit. And they showed me a way out of that seemingly inescapable hole. And as a result of this program, I've been able to do a lot in the last 18 and a half years. I sobered up at 46. I drank and used morning, noon, and night from the age of 20 to the age of 46. And I've done more in my life in the last 18 and a half years than I did in the first 46. That's what this program has done for me. One of the first things I started working on with the principles of the program was my marriage. I was an awful drunk addict. I was always angry, murderous, black, depressive rages all the time. And I terrorized my family, you know, smashing things, punching holes in the wall. It was just awful to be around. And I started applying the principles of the program, and I just celebrated 32 years of marriage with my wife this year. My wife is my best friend, my business partner, my soulmate. It's kind of like marbled meat. I don't know where I end and she begins. It's that kind of a relationship. And it really is an amazing thing, amazing gift that CA has given me in that respect. My children, I have a daughter, stepdaughter, who's 36, and my son's 38. My stepdaughter was estranged from me. She actually ended up in therapy over me, and it hurt me because I love my daughter, and I use these principles of the program to atone for my transgressions and work really hard at being a good, loving father to her. My daughter comes over every Thursday for dinner. We usually play cards or games or build puzzles. I taught her how to play Texas No Limit Hold'em heads-up poker, and she absolutely loves it, so we have a great time. My son is 38. Now, my son has an 11-year-old boy who's severely autistic. He doesn't speak, and it's worrisome for me. And I know there's tremendous challenges that go with that experience. And so for me to be sober, to be there to support my son, to be there to help him navigate those challenges, again, another gift that CA has given me and my family and my life. My liver went back to normal after 6 years. There's a passage in the big book that says, go out and see what other religious people are doing. So, you know, being a normal sort of person, I thought, I'll go get a degree, you know. And so I enrolled in the University of Toronto, 18th ranked Ivy League university in the world. Now, there are three things I see that are really strong predictors of good recovery. One is we work with others. Two, we go back to school. You know, we improve ourselves for our families, our careers, our lives. You know, the third thing I see addicts do that show me they have good recovery, and I've heard a number of conversations over the weekend, they fix their teeth, right? Because who's got money for teeth when we're out there, right? So when I see someone, you know, doing all those things, and if you're going to dental school, hey, you're golden. So I went to the University of Toronto and I graduated 2016 out of 3,000 students, and they lined us up with GPA from the highest to the lowest. And I was number 7 out of 3,000 in medical anthropology and religions. Yeah, pretty amazing. A gift, just a gift. I got involved in CA. I love service. You know, we have the principles of our program, our recovery legacy. Then we have the fellowship and our unity and our traditions. And then we have this amazing thing we call the service structure at the group level, the district area level, and the world level, where we actualize those principles in a service structure to be of maximum usefulness to God and our fellows. And that is the icing on the cake. So if you're familiar with the steps and you're familiar with the traditions, you're not involved in service, man, you're missing out on a really important part of this amazing journey that we're on. And I highly recommend it. And we're always looking for good, trusted servants to step up and be of maximum service. I've started many groups. I've been GSR, I've been secretary, I've been treasurer. I got involved in area. I've done most of the positions at the area level, served on 9 conventions. And then I got involved in World Services, where I've been the archive chair far too long when I talked to Tom about it. I should have rotated out 3 years ago. I have a love-hate relationship with tradition, too, and the spirit of rotation. Because I just know more than everybody. But I love being of service to Cocaine Anonymous. God gave me a big mouth, so I've done a lot of speaking over the, especially with COVID and the fellowship being able to access me for talks. And I can make a computer pretty much do anything except have sex with me, and if I could do that, I wouldn't be here right now. But I built the world website, and I've done about 30, 35 area websites, group websites, and I just love being helpful to carrying the message. And everything we do in CA, especially even at the world level with the trustees and the World Service Office Board and all the hoopla that goes with it, never forget, everything we do is designed to do one thing. And we do this in the group. That's the firing lines. That's the front lines. That's the building block of our fellowship. Allowing the members of the group to do what they do best, and that's carry the message to the addict that still suffers. That's the primary purpose. So that, to me, you know, when I opened up, I said I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous, because I think there's a vast difference between being a member of Cocaine Anonymous and being an untreated addict. And this is what it means to me to be a member of Cocaine Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use it and done some pretty amazing things in my life as a result of this program. So how did I get from this 26-year losing streak to this 18-and-a-half-year winning streak? What happened? So I came into the rooms, and like I said, I was fortunate enough to meet someone who was armed with the facts about themselves. And we didn't go to a meeting. I remember this person approached me and saying, "Cameron, I'm watching you die." He said, "Let me show you how to work a program." Now, we didn't go to another meeting. We went to a coffee shop, opened up big books, and started working steps. And the first thing he said to me was, he says, "Cameron, you're going to be a sponsor." That was his very first message to me. "You are going to be a sponsor. The whole foundation stone of your recovery rests on you being a sponsor." He says, "Do you know in the first 88 pages of the big book, before we get into the chapter working with others on page 89, it mentions in the first 88 pages 124 times work with another alcoholic. And they don't mean your sponsor. They mean work with the guy or the gal that's in the hole and show them a way to climb out." Bill and Bob understood the power of one alcoholic, one addict working with another. You know, and I find it's not a hierarchical system. Like, I'm a peer. I'm looking for the power you're all looking for, too. I look for it every day. And so when I work with newcomers, I do it arm in arm as peer to peer. And together, we go seek this great reality, this power. And I want to be there when you light up, because when you light up, I light up. And, you know, that's the amazing thing about sponsorship. So I tend to, you know, take this co-sponsorship approach, and we do our steps together. They work their steps, I work my steps, we share our experiences, and some pretty amazing things start to happen. When I was at university, I studied medical anthropology, which is the study of humans and their various healing systems. And of course, 12 steps is an alternative healing system. And I was writing this paper and I was doing research, and I came across this really fascinating academic article that was a drug study conducted in Baltimore, Maryland in the year 2000. And they had 500 injection drug users. These were heroin and cocaine injection users. And they followed their trajectory into the rooms of AA and NA. And they had three groups: those with sponsors, those without sponsors, and those that sponsored others. And at the end of 1 year, they looked at the abstinent rates. Now, those with sponsors and without sponsors, there was absolutely no difference in their sobriety rate, which was 30%. Now, that signifies two things. One, you're just as likely to sober up with or without a sponsor. And two, having a sponsor is no predication of power. One of the first things I tell the newcomer is, "I am not the power. I will fail you. I'm not going to be there when you need me the most, and I'm certainly going to say something that's going to piss you off. I am not the power." But those that were sponsoring others, 75% of that group was still sober at the end of the first year, signifying all the power, all the efficacy of our 12-step program is availed to us by sponsoring others. We get to keep it by giving it away. We pay it forward, right? That's the magic. Some people call it the law of harvest, karma. We reap what we sow. But that's the spiritual dynamic that goes on. And as I opened up with James 5, 19 and 20, which I believe is where the 12-step comes from, when we show a person that path back to the truth, we not only save a soul, but cover a multitude of sin. And I had a lot of sin to atone for. I'm what's called a big book sponsor. I love the big book of AA. It's written like a recovery text. It's a very unique book in its instructional way that Bill constructed those 12 steps and how he wrote about them. And it's like a recipe. How many people here made their own crack? Not the ether-based crack, the soda crack. Who made their own crack here, right? There's a recipe to it, right? You know, you pick up your powder, you pick up your soda, you mix it up. Now, if you put too much soda into the powder, what do you get? You get soda rock, and that really sucks because there's no ringer. And if you don't put enough soda in, you get a blob of goo, and that doesn't cook well on the pipe, and that really sucks. But if you do it just right, you get a little crystal ball, you pop it on your pipe, you do your blast, you get your ringer and all that funky behavior that goes with it. I love the recipe. Well, our 12 steps is written very much like that. There's a recipe, and if you follow the steps in exact measure as they're laid out in the text of the big book, the end result is a spiritual awakening. A spiritual awakening that's so powerful that allows us to easily control that desire to drink, use, or if you suffer from some of the acting out addictions, to the acting out. Like, you know, sex, food, gambling. I'm a drug addict alcoholic, but I've worked with all sorts of addicts all over the world and have used the same approach and seen the same miracle occur for addictions I don't even share. And that's a pretty amazing thing to bear witness to. One of the biggest controversies I have in the room is how quickly should we take the newcomer through the 12 steps? Now, some people say a year. I don't think most of us have a year, especially a year of sobriety. That's brutal. White knuckling it just for today. I'm not going to do it just for today. That you know, lack of power, that's my dilemma, right? If I don't find a power, I'm going back out. I even think 30 days is a little dicey. I know the Back to Beginner meetings of 1940 that Wally P. out of Arizona wrote in his book Back to Basics, where they took all 12 steps in 4 one-hour sessions. But I think even 30 days can be a bit dicey. I've worked with a lot of addicts that don't have a couple of days, let alone weeks, to work a solution. So I think of it, you know, I think of AA. It's a little pejorative, but I think of AA as a retirement home for grumpy old men. NA's the fucking insane asylum. But CA's the emergency ward. We do soul surgery in CA. And we got a solution. And it works. So come on in. So when I take someone through the 12 steps, I do it in roughly about 10 days. Sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more. But I realize there's an urgency at play. We got to get this person through the steps and get them out sponsoring others so they can enjoy the same joy and freedom we have. Because think about it. What do sponsors always talk about? We talk about our newcomers relapsing, right? Now, I know some sponsors do relapse, but the proportions are quite different. So my job is to get them through the steps as quickly as possible. And if you know your AA history, you know, Ebbie Thatcher was 60 days sober when he carried the message to Bill. Dr. Bob was 2 weeks sober when they carried the message to Bill Dotson, AA number 3 in the town's hospital. Bill was only 7 days out of his third treatment in detox and was out frantically working with other addicts or alcoholics. I love the story he sold himself short, the story of Earl T., right? Earl T. founded AA Chicago, and Earl T. had been hanging around the rooms of Akron for a bit there, you know, going to the meetings, wondering, does he really want to be in the deal? And he decides he wants to do it. So he goes to Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob takes him into his office, and they get on their knees, and they immediately do a step 3 prayer. Bob didn't even wait to hear Earl's inventory. He just told Earl what his inventory was. You self-centered, self-seeking, conceited, sarcastic son of a bitch. Now let's talk about that, right? He just told him his inventory. And then they looked at the amends and how to atone, and how to work the program daily. And then he cut them loose. He says, go start AA Chicago. Come on back to Akron every couple months. Let's talk about your experience. Because they all knew the power of the program was carrying the message to the alcoholic addict that still suffers and show them how to work it. So step 2, you know, I love step 2. It says, came to believe in a power greater than yourself that restores to sanity. Came to believe. Now that infers a process. I'm going to go through some kind of process where I'm going to wake up. Most addicts, when they come into the rooms, they're asleep. Like, they're barely toilet-trained aides. They eat, they defecate, they fornicate. That's about all they're good for, right? Now, it's okay. That's the bottom line for any species on the planet. But we can transcend that reptilian fight-flight brain of ours and, you know, engage these prefrontal lobes and transcend and have a divine experience. And step two is a very simple step. There's three things that take place in step two. First of all, where do we find this power? And the big book's very instructive. We find the great reality deep down within ourselves, right? Now, that's another paradox. I need a power greater than me. I need a power greater than the cocaine, greater than the heroin, greater than the alcohol. And where do I find this power? I find this power deep down within me. That's a paradox. So three things take place in coming to grips with step two. One is we let the testimony of others bear witness to the power of God doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. It's bearing witness. I look at Jennifer with 41 years and Tom, you know, they bear witness to a power working through them. They don't drink or use anymore. And that's compelling to me as an alcoholic addict who can't stop. Hey, you're like me and I'm like you, but you don't do it anymore. And I want what you got, right? That's what we're here to do when we carry the message of the newcomer, to bear witness to that power. You all think of someone you know who's just like you or even gone down further than you have, who claims a power greater than themselves and restored them to sanity. The second thing is the ability to be honest with ourselves. You know, if we're going to defeat the liar, the cornerstone spiritual principle is honesty. And the third thing is to search diligently within ourselves, and we too can find this power. And that's all step two is. You know, a great American sponsor, we had him up at our convention in Toronto back in 2010, Mark Houston, he passed away. But he was an amazing spiritual speaker. And he used to tell this story about this guy who decides to go duck hunting with his buddy. And he takes his dog and they go out and he shoots a duck and it drops in the middle of the pond. And the dog gets up and walks across the water, picks up the duck and brings it back. And his buddy doesn't say anything. Shoots another duck, drops in the middle of the pond. The dog gets up, walks on the water, picks up the duck, brings it back. Still he doesn't say anything. So his friend turns to his buddy and says, "Hey, do you see anything wrong with my dog?" And he goes, "Yeah, that dog can't swim." Missing the miracle of a dog walking on water. You know, when the newcomer comes in the room, they're asleep. They're not aware of it. And that's why our stories are so important. The diversity of our stories. Every one of us has a story to share. Tom was talking about this last night. We all have a story to share. And somewhere in the room, there is an ear that desperately needs to hear your story so that they can identify and say, "I'm like you, you're like me, you don't do it anymore. I want what you got." And we can take them on that amazing journey of our 12 steps. Step three. I love step three. Step three is my baptism, my confirmation in the program. Step three is when we decide I'm going to be in this deal. Now, step three says we made a decision, turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand it. What do we mean by that? What do? We turn our will over. What does that mean? It means my thinking. I'm going to turn my thinking over to God. Why should I want to turn my thinking over to God? Because who's running my brain as an untreated addict? The liar, and the liar always wins. So I'm going to fire the liar, and I'm going to hire God. And the second part of step three is that I'm going to turn my actions, my life, my behavior over to doing God's will. See, a lot of people seem to think that 12 steps is about quitting. But if you understand your step one proposition, we can't quit. We will drink. We will use a game. So we go a different way in step three. We make a decision to fire the liar. I'm no longer in the Cameron business. I'm in the God Inc. business. God is the principal. I'm the agent. You know, I always thought it'd be a cool business card to hand out. God Inc., Cameron F., agent of God. Hi, I'm an agent of God. How can I be helpful? But that's our new job description, right? We're in the God business now. And in doing my daily, just for today, I'm going to do God's will. A lot of people construed as just for today, I'm not going to drink or use. But that's an untenable position. It's just for today, I'm going to do God's will. Just for today, I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be pure. I'm going to be unselfish. And I'm going to be loving in all my affairs of the day. And I start my day with that affirmation of the step three prayer, followed by a meditation on what my day is going to look like when I'm with my family, when I'm with my children, when I'm working with clients or in the rooms. What does God's will look like in my day as an honest, pure, unselfish, loving individual? And in the application of that, those spiritual principles, I access a power that lets me easily control that desire to drink or use. That's the key. That's the secret of our program. Now, the first time I tried to meditate and connect to God, oh my God, this racket, this cacophony of noise inside my head full of resentments and harms and guilt and shame and fears. And oh my God, it was so thunderous. How do I find this spark of reality deep down within myself? So step four and five is a process where we get right with ourselves. It's a moral, a fearless and searching moral inventory. Now, this is a key point. Remember, 12 steps is not secular, it's not psychological. It's a moral, spiritual approach to the efficacy of addiction. So I'm going to do this moral inventory where I'm going to tease out my shortcomings, my character defects, the root causes of my problem. And, you know, we have three areas of our life that we look at. We look at our resentments, we look at our fears, and we look at our harms to others. And we tease out this inventory. And I remember going through all these relationships that I destroyed, and the same character defects kept coming up in every item. And those defects were arrogance, bigotry, misogyny, rudeness, misanthropy. If you don't know what misanthropy means, it's the loathing of my own species. Sometimes when I'm really misanthropic, I just say, God, hurl an asteroid as obliterate the planet. I don't even mind dying knowing you're all coming with me. That's misanthropy. It's an awful, awful defect. I'm slanderous. I'm gossip. I'm hateful. I'm vulgar. I think immorally. I suffer, the Germans call it Schadenfreude. I just learned this defect this year about myself. The Germans call it Schadenfreude. The English version is epicaricacy. What it means is taking great pleasure in other people's misfortune. And that's an awful defect. I'm indiscreet. I'm full of biases and unfair judgments. And at the end of the list that kept coming up again and again, I remember my sponsor looking at the list and he goes, "You see that list, Cameron? That's your resume as an untreated addict. Next time you go for a job interview or post an eHarmony profile, that's what you should be posting because that's what they're getting." And I really found that objectionable. But what's great about step four and five in this process of getting right with ourselves, and I realize all these character defects, nothing good is happening in that fourth column. It is an impediment to the spiritual experience. I am blocked from God itself. But in the realization of what these specific myriad of character defects are, it reveals where the power is for me. And so instead of hatred, it's forgiveness. Instead of arrogance, it's humility. Instead of bigotry, misogyny, rudeness, it's kindness, courtesy, respect, and so on. And now I have a track to run on. And more importantly, I understand in that step three proposition what the bondage of Cameron really looks like. And more importantly, what God's will is for me throughout my day. And that's my job description, is all those spiritual principles. Now, here's another paradox. God hires people with the worst resumes to do his work. That's absolutely amazing, considering what we were like as untreated addicts and doing God's will and the amazing things that we do and in this amazing fellowship. Now, if all we needed to know was step four and five, to understand our character defects and God's will, we'd only have five steps. But as many of us know, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, behavioral modification doesn't seem to work for us. So we need a divine intervention. We need a spiritual intervention. And step six and seven is a process where I get right with God. In step six, I get entirely ready. I see how objectionable this man is I've created in my fourth column. And I don't want to be this man. I get entirely ready because I see the futility and the fatality and the destructiveness. And I see it in black and white with all the destroyed relationships, what these character defects are doing to my life. And I remember Tom talking about, you know, the getting a hit of the destruction we do to our families and our communities and our careers. Oh my God, it's just awful. And I get that hit of futility and fatality and destructiveness. And I get entirely ready to have God remove them. Now, one caveat, when I argue for my limitations, when I argue for my character defects, congratulations, I get to keep them, right? God will not remove from me any defect that I'm willing to argue for. And sometimes I will argue for a resentment or argue for some kind of character defect that's popping up. And God says, well, okay, let's do it your way, Cameron. There's a paycheck for doing it your way, and you're welcome to it. So I get a hit of that futility, fatality, and destructiveness. And then in step seven, I get right with God through this amazing step seven prayer. Now, I start my day with conscious awakening. I wake up. That's what I love about our program. It's about waking up, you know, waking up to the reality of this divine experience and making the decision of going God's way and staying cognizant. Am I living in column four? Am I in that fifth column doing God's will and being mindful throughout my day? And then I close my day with that step seven prayer where I ask God, remove these character defects. This is what I noticed today. This popped up. Please give me the willingness to let them go. Give me the strength to be the man I'm meant to be doing your will. And I get right with God in six and seven. And then in 8 and 9, we get right with others. You know, we learn these spiritual principles and we start to apply them to all those destroyed relationships and making reparations to our past. And we carry those spiritual principles. I'll share one quick amend I made. There was a woman I was a business partner with, and you know, it did not go well in the end. And there was a lot of resentment, a lot of judgment. And I used to publish these awful articles about this person and her business online. And whenever you did a Google search for her, you would see these awful documents. And for years, she tried to reach me and tried to get me to remove them. And, you know, I was untreated and I was living in my resentments. And so when I was working my program, you know, I realized the error of my ways here. And I needed to clean this up. So I approached, the first thing I did is I removed all these documents. You can't find these documents now when you search for her. And I went to her, and I confessed my part, my judgment, my hatred, my slander, my gossip. And at the end of the atonement, I said to her, what more can I do to set right this wrong? And if you're ever wondering how to set right a wrong with someone, you don't know how to make the amend, just ask them, how should I make this amend? They'll let you know. I've had a few people tell me to drop dead, and I do intend to make that amend, but not today. And after I asked her, I said, what can I do to make this right? She looked at me and she said, God bless you, Cameron. I just want the door to our friendship to remain open. Now, I was not prepared for what happened. Because I'm seeking this inward reality and I'm working my program and I'm atoning for these transgressions, they were removed. They were purged from my system. And now they're not there. There's a void. And it filled with that spirit. And my knees buckled, and I fell to my knees. That's how hard it hit me. And to this very day, and I made this amend many, many, many years ago, I still walk with that divine reality, that connection to that presence this very day. Amends, amazing. And this vehicle of 1 to 9, look at the power we have in this program. This whole program is about power. And step one, I realize I have no power. I'm powerless. I will drink. I will use again. Yet I come into the rooms. I meet people who are just like me that don't do it anymore. So I know there's power out there. I see it bearing witness in people. And then I make a decision. I'm going to go look for this power too. And then in step four and five, I realize what blocks me from the power and what gives me access to that power. And by 8 and 9, I'm wielding a power through me that I'm cleaning up the wreckage of my past. And this vehicle rockets me into that fourth dimension of existence. I've entered the spirit world. And then I'm given those amazing disciplines of 10 and 11, a design for living that really works, a program of living my life without booze and drugs. You know, whenever I've got I'm frustrated because the world isn't doing what I want it to do, because I obviously know more than most people. I got the discipline of step three. Hey, you're no longer in the camera business. You're in the God business now. You know, if I got a character defect popping up, or I've got some fear going on, I got the disciplines of steps four and five to work with. If I've done damage to someone, I've hurt somebody, I've acted out in an inappropriate way, I've got the disciplines of eight and nine. If I need greater conscious contact with that divine reality deep down within myself, I have the disciplines of prayer and meditation. And so I wake up, I live in conscious contact with this divine reality, and I frame my day so nicely with that step three prayer and execute my day on that meditation, and then I close my day with that step seven prayer. And it's worked really well for me over these past 18 and a half years. And then having had this spiritual awakening, I try to carry the message to the addict that still suffers and practice these principles in all my affairs. Now, what I consider for me a balanced program is I take care of my family first. I take care of what God has given me. And I work my program so I can be of maximum usefulness to my family. And then second in priority is my career, my job, my income, because if I'm not self-supporting, I can't take care of my family. And then in my spare time, part-time as an avocation, I carry the message to the addict that still suffers. Nothing ensures immunity as intensive work with other addicts. It works when all other activities fail. You know, over the last 18 years of working with addicts, remember, you know, we can secure their confidence because we know what it's like to be in the hole. We know what it's like to live as an addict. And we can secure their confidence because we bear witness to a power in us where we don't do it anymore. But we must remember that they're very ill. They're sick, right? They're sick people. In 18 and a half years, I've been lied to. I've been robbed. I've been verbally abused. I've been physically threatened. I've been sexually harassed. I was working with this one woman, and it was on Zoom. And man, it was going so great for a while. We did the step four, and we're connecting. She was a sex trade worker from the age of, I think it was 19 to 52. And then all of a sudden I get like 80 texts from her, you know, going on about this and that. Why am I not responding? I'm like, uh-oh, block, 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 block. Next thing you know, my wife's getting a call. This is such and such. You've emasculated your husband and you have to step aside and allow me to have sex with Cameron so I can heal him. And my wife's going, who the bleepity bleep 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 is this? Oh my God. There's a passage in the Gospels. Behold, we are sent out as sheep amongst the wolves. Be wary like serpents, but gentle like doves. Meaning keep your wits about you. We work with dangerous people. I've worked with some really dangerous people. So when you're working with others, and especially if you work with the opposite sex, I work with men, women, gays, lesbians, blacks, whites, Jews, Christians. I really don't care. Whatever God puts in front of me, I work with. I never get to choose the people I want to work with, or I choose a big-breasted sex addict with a history of relapse. I get clocked for cracking off like that. You know, God really puts it in my face. I have such an animosity for police officers. I really don't like them. And I did a lot of inventory around cops, which is odd because I was never really abused by them. But, you know, to me, they're thugs of the state. And I have a lot of fear of authority and fear of no control. And God puts an inordinate amount of cops in my life to work with. And he smashes humility and love and tolerance into my life. And it's just the odd thing. I never get to choose who I work with. They show up and they want what I have. And, you know, again, Mark Houston used to say, when you don't care, I can't. And when you do care, I must. You know, when you sit down with someone and they're so down in the hole and you think, oh my God, this person's never going to crawl out. But they're asking us for help. And we deliver our program, and to watch them crawl out of the hole and to watch them recover and then to bear witness to them paying it forward to another addict. And I know some of you have sponsored people and witnesses, and that's the best dope there is. It's the God dope. It's the spiritual dope. It's a ringer every time I see it, right? That's an amazing thing to be a part of. You don't want to miss out on that experience. It only takes a day to learn it, the rest of your life to work with it. And, you know, if you know how to work a 12-step program, you know, business is booming. You know, don't be afraid to reach out, you know. You're not going to fuck them up any more than they're already fucked up, right? So throw them a freaking bone. Show them how to work it. You just might save a soul. Look at the power of step 12. Everybody has failed the addict. The treatment centers, the medical community, religious community, our friends, family, the employer. Yet we, as lay addicts, armed with the facts about ourselves, our common solution and generosity of spirit, God wields a power through us who turns us into healers. We heal the seemingly hopeless. Now that's power. So the next time you hear the addict crying out from the hole, what should we do? We should jump into the hole with them. And they're very bewildered when we do that. They look at us and go, now we're both in this hole. But we can turn to our brothers and sisters with a wink in our eye and we can say, it's okay. I've been here before. I got a way out. I got a way out for more hope, faith, and courage. I got a way out to walk hand in hand with the sunlight of the Spirit. I've got a way out to be an intelligent agent, a spearhead of God's ever-advancing creation. And I'm for that. How about you? God bless you and see you on the firing line to recovery. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Natalie.
That is beautiful.